Andrew Greeley wrote in the Chicago Tribune about today's guest. Who and what is Robert Coles? Social scientist, humanist, political activist, psychiatrist, minstrel, wandering storyteller, mystic, wise man, poet, dissenter, and yes, I'll use the word secular saint. I invite anyone to Google the books of Robert Coles. He has written prolifically on a broad range of topics, but consistently on subjects that matter. Much of his work is about story. Much is about children. Some is about poverty, about art, about spirit, about meaning. Coles' technique is to get to know people, ask them significant questions, and simply let them speak. He strongly believes that people's stories speak for themselves. I plan to talk with him today about the power of story, the story of Thanksgiving, the story of this moment of multiple crises and the emergence of Obama, and about his newest book, Minding the Store, Great Writings About Business. What might it say to and about today's crises when it appears that business and finance have lost their way? Robert Coles is the former James Agee Professor of Social Ethics at Harvard University, where he taught at Harvard Business School and Harvard Law School. His work has been recognized with numerous awards, including a Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction in 73 for his series of books, Children of Crisis, which is really an amazing work of five books in which basically, as I've said, children do most of the talking. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1981, the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1998, and the National Humanities Medal in 2001. He co-founded the magazine Double Take, a high-quality magazine which documented the lives of ordinary people with photographs and articles. He's written over 75 books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Children of Crisis, best-selling The Moral Intelligence of Children, The Spiritual Intelligence of Children, The Call of Stories, Growing Up Poor, Bruce Springsteen's America, and his newest, Minding the Store, Great Writing About Business from Tolstoy to Now, of which he is co-editor. Welcome, Robert Coles.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, what I, as I said in the intro, what I want to do is talk about story, what drew you to story, your understanding of what you mean when you say story, and then look at some things in the world through the prism of story. So, first of all, what do you mean when you say story?
Well, by stories, I mean a person talking about himself or herself and giving those words some kind of coherence so that another person can listen and understand. And then there are writers who take the voices in their minds and put them down on paper in words with the same intention. They take out of the what William James, an American psychologist, called blooming, buzzing confusion of everyday life. The storyteller pulls it together and finds a certain, well, yes, a story and at a coherence that makes sense to another person. So storytelling, in a way, is affirming who we are. That we're the creature of language. Unlike all the other creatures that populate this planet, we use words, and we pull them together in order to connect with other people. That's what storytelling is about. If you stop and think about the oldest books, including going back to the Bible, there are stories in those books which are meant to illustrate what it is that the particular person speaking and or writing had in mind.
Okay, I know that one of your Harvard colleagues for many years, Stephen Jay Gould, he actually says that human beings are the primate who tells stories.
Well, that's a very nice way of putting it, and I would certainly agree with him. I certainly would agree with him. You know, the American novelist Walker Percy used to talk about this, and he'd say, if you want a definition of what a human being is, the definition could probably begin with that use of language to convey to another person a story. And that's, by the way, what do we do as parents with our children? We bring them up by telling them one story after another in order to make sense of this world for them. And by the way, as we're doing so, we're making sense for ourselves yet again. And of course, a story is a two-way street. You tell a story to someone, they listen, and you respond to their attentiveness and listening. And in a sense, you hear your own story amplified through the other person's reaction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a great novelist, E.M. Forster, who once put it very brilliantly, and I think I mentioned that in the book, he said very tersely, only connect. And what he meant by connect is talk to someone else in such a way that they get what you're saying, and you in turn learn from them their reaction to that.
So it's that dynamic between the teller and the listener in which the story actually lives.
That's right, the teller and the listener. You said it very well just then.
Thank you. Let me ask you a couple of other things about it, because some people would say, oh, there's a formal structure to story, or at least there's a traditional or a classical. You know, Aristotle says it, the screenplay teachers say it, in which you've got protagonist, inciting incident, goal, and that it's the pursuit of that goal, overcoming obstacles and so on, that is the story. But it sounds like you say a story can happen without a lot of those sort of pieces, as long as it's someone making cohesive sense of life.
That's right. Well, of course, you start bringing up Aristotle, or for that matter, Freud, or any of the great people, whether it be in philosophy or psychology or whatever. Of course, they will analyze what we're talking about, and they'll come up with their analytic constructions. But you don't have to get that complicated, if I may say so, to get to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter, I think, is the mind and heart of one person moving out to the world and through language conveying some interest in understanding, and maybe understanding another person through conversation and through shared discussions, usually the sharing of stories. I happen to be a child psychiatrist, and I've watched children for years, over the years, learn how to tell stories, and I've seen the wonderful satisfaction, heard it in their voices and seen it on their faces when they know how to say something that is understood by another person. And one young lady, she was only 7 years old, I'll never forget, she turned to me and she said, you know, I have a friend, and we tell each other what happened during the day, and then at the end we always say something like, well, that's the story of today. I said, oh, my God. She doesn't need to write a book like me. She has it right there.
And she has it every day.
She can read anything. She can study philosophy or psychology. She just knew it out of her humanity.
What drew you to story? And I'm going to set that up by saying that in your work, your early work, when you were working as a child psychiatrist and you were writing in psychology and so on, you didn't go for a lot of what the field was going for at that point. As I said at the top, you let people speak for themselves. What drew you to story?
Well, what drew me to stories is that as I became interested in them, I realized that I was getting closer to my own humanity, never mind those of the people I was involved with, in the sense that I was being given pause about what this life does mean. But let me give you an example. When I was learning to be a doctor, I'll never forget, we had a polio epidemic in Boston, and a lot of kids were in the children's hospital then. That's before the Salk vaccine came into use. We're talking about the 1950s before that vaccine. But I will never forget a boy lying on his back, paralyzed from the waist down. He couldn't move his legs. And he turned to me and he told me that he's worried about me.
Worried about you?
Yeah, and I looked at him and I said, wow, why are you worried about me? He said, well, you're tired. You're working so hard. And then I said, well, I guess you're right. What would you suggest that I do? And then I was stunned. He said, well, you could go and take a rest, but what I think you might do is just go and get a good book that tells you a good story that relaxes you. I'll never forget it. And I thought, this kid knows a lot better about psychology and psychiatry than I do.
Wow.
What I needed is to kind of pull myself together and maybe stop and think about what I was doing and why I was doing it.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean,
moment, I can still picture it and I can see him.
Mm. Well, one thing that's wonderful in that is it is both a child and it is story. I mean, what then became very much the focus of your work for, what, 20 years?
Well, it became the focus of my work from when I started doing this work. You're absolutely right, around 1960, so we're talking about a half a century.
Oh, my God.
Of listening to people all over the world. I'll never forget, I went with one of my sons to South Africa, at that time under apartheid, and I got to meet some kids, both the Afrikaner kids, the English-speaking white kids, and also, of course, the kids who were African. I heard different stories from each group about what was happening in that nation at the time. And then I'll never forget one of the kids who actually came from a rather conservative Afrikaner background. He turned to me and he said, you're hearing all sides of the story. He said, that's the way he put it. I said, I'm trying to. He said, well, are you going to pull a story out of this that everyone can pay attention to? I said, I guess that's my job as a writer. But you'll notice he was talking about stories as told, and in a way as told by the one who hears stories, namely, in this case, me. But we all do that with one another. We listen to others, we interpret what we've heard, and then we tell it to other people, as do people when they give an account to someone of what happened to them that day, including the people they met, heard from, talked to, and now, in a summary form, go over it with another person.
Right, right. One of the things I actually talk to a lot of nonprofits and foundations when I'm not on the radio about communicating their message, and I encourage them that the most powerful tool that they have is compelling human stories. And two of the things that I say, and I'm just going to get your feedback on this, when I'm trying to get them to transition from writing reports or dealing in sort of a dead language of academia or science or something, to bring it to life. And one of the ways that I say that most brings it to life is snatches of dialogue. And it's interesting, in every example you've gone to, it's the actual words that someone spoke to you 50 years ago, 30 years ago, that are what you are passing on at this moment years later.
That's right. And that's, you know, we're the creature who not only speaks to others and listens to them and understands, but we're, in a way, I'll put it this way, we're the creature who remembers and then takes that remembrance, as one novelist put it, remembrance of things past. We take that remembrance and convey it to other people in our own way, making a story out of larger stories, whether they be the larger stories of what we've gone through in a particular day or over the years, or the particular story of a book, of an article, or for that matter, something they heard on the radio or seen or saw on television. And that's who we are, the one who listens, watches, then connects the heard and the seen into the coherence of a story that is, you want to call it a tale, you want to call it a narrative, whatever. It's the person realizing his or her humanity through sentences that accumulate and become ultimately, may I call it, an unfolding of what was, so that the other person might understand that and maybe make a part of his or her life.
So the
storytelling comes near to what that expression, I thou.
Mm-hmm.
Storytelling is the medium that I and thou connect.
Mm-hmm. And and it is what the power of the story, or the reason that people go to it and exchange it, is for themselves understanding, and then for connection.
I think it's for both.
Yeah.
I think it's very hard for us to understand without the companionship, shall I put it, of connection, which is what we learn when we're children, because, remember, it's our mothers and fathers and grandparents and others in the home who are adult, who enable us through words to make sense of the world, and the enablement is often done through telling something, through constructing a story that makes sense to the person who was, after all, trying to grow up and figure things out.
Okay, it's interesting you just began to talk about the place of story in family, because one of the questions that is on my mind is, today's Tuesday, Thursday will be Thanksgiving. And I want to ask you the question, what is the story of Thanksgiving at this time in America? And what I mean by, what does this holiday that is neither religious nor patriotic, really, and yet is an essential American holiday, perhaps the only one that isn't either religious or patriotic, and the holiday, it seems to me, that most brings families together, I think even more than Christmas, people... That's what Thanksgiving's about, is that they will get together with their multi-generational or even their in-laws, their interwoven families and so on. What does Thanksgiving mean to people?
Well, you put it very well. What Thanksgiving means ultimately is a way of commemorating human experience. In this case, the human experience that enabled this country to begin, namely people, after all, they crossed an ocean. I wasn't getting on a jet plane or even a big fast Queen Mary or Queen Elizabeth like those old ships were before they were replaced by airplanes. But these were people in a very tough way had to cross the ocean without the usual things that we take for granted in travel. And they came upon a whole new world. And they landed on that rock. And they, in a way, gave thanks to one another, gave thanks to fate, chance, and accidents, you could put it, but somehow through all the difficulties and turmoil, they got there. And there they were looking at one another, trying to figure out, what do we do next?
Exactly.
And when you try to do that, let's face it, what do? You stop maybe and have something to eat, you look at one another, and you're thankful. And then you say, well, let's celebrate. Here we are, which is what we do on Thanksgiving. This is a new country founded by people who came from all over the world, who were taking a chance, crossing an ocean, coming into a new world, and saying to one another at Thanksgiving, by golly, one way or another, at one time or another, we came here, and look what we did. We built something up out of this. So Thanksgiving, in a way, is a way of honoring the birth and then the growth and development of a whole new nation, a whole new world, uniting it all together in the United States of America, which is also the united experiences that make up America. That's what the story of Thanksgiving is about. It's about a nation's story as pinpointed in one moment in it.
Right.
You could call it a founding story that then becomes a national moment of pause and reflection and thanksgiving equals celebration and gratitude.
One thing I was thinking about is, so families are going to be driving and flying and so on back to join each other this year at Thanksgiving. And I'm curious what you sense the feeling may be this year. We were sold fear for most of the last 8 years as a political tool, and yet now I sense that the fear is real. The future is uncertain. times are tough for young families. The future is going to be tough, perhaps for children, tougher than it has been, and they're really scary for seniors. The parents and grandparents that are coming together who aren't sure where their pensions are going to be or their home value that they've lost. What do you sense is going to be that American story this Thanksgiving, facing the economic and financial crises that are emerging and all around them?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be literally a time of Thanksgiving, frankly, because instead of having a sentence that ends with a period or an exclamation mark, I'd have it with a few semicolons in it, because there are a series of stories within any statement that one would want to make about, for instance, what we're all going to be thinking of come Thursday. And I'd put it this way: yes, powerful country in the world, and by powerful, I don't mean only militarily. It's powerful because it has an enormous moral, even spiritual, tradition to it, which is of from many one, and a belief, you know, a belief in the destiny of humanity, that people are created and equal, mind you, and endowed with certain inalienable rights, right in our political documents, right in our historical documents of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, is everything that I think people on a Thanksgiving can say to themselves: by golly, thank God we're here in this great country. Think of all the other countries and the empires and the boasts of this or that national system. But this country has gone on now, let's face it, for three centuries, from the 17th century now through into the 21st, and here we are, a great country, I might say so, and I don't think this is national egoism. We might say that we're the envy of the world.
Well, let me go into that a little bit with you, Professor Coles. You've written a lot, actually, about, or the words of, people who have been let down by society. A lot of the people who dealt with poverty or dealt with discrimination and so on. And let me first lay out what I see as a crisis in our country, and it links to your book about business as well. So just let me set this up for a second, and then I want you to respond to this. I see our country going through a crisis of accountability, that we had the corporate crises a few years ago of Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, and so on, which it turned out the problem wouldn't have been as bad if the accounting firms, the Arthur Andersons and so on, had been doing their job of providing the accountability to these people that were getting so corrupt and creative, shall we say. And so there, the problem was much worse, and people lost much more because accountability wasn't there where it should be. Iraq has been funded for 5 years by emergency supplementals. I ask people why this is, why we don't recognize that this is an ongoing expense and should be part of the regular budget, why the Democrats, when they got into Congress, didn't take that on. And the word I get is that then Congress would have to be accountable. As long as they keep it as an emergency supplemental, it's kind of off the books almost. Then we have the financial crisis, where these exotic instruments, the derivatives, the credit default swaps and so on, were being okayed by the Standard & Poor's and the Moody's, again, the firms that were supposed to provide the accountability but didn't. So in all three cases, we have massive failure, and the failure is made much worse and the cost much greater because the people who are supposed to be in place to provide accountability are not. What does that say about our culture and our society and the story of America?
Well, look, sometimes we make mistakes, and sometimes things don't work out. There are flaws in any collection of human beings and in any society. But allowing for those flaws, I would like, especially in a Thanksgiving week, to emphasize the positive side, that through all these mistakes and errors, let's face it, here we are, and we've done pretty well. And I'm not going to defend some of the practices that we now witness or read about, whether it be in the business world or the political world. Mistakes, you bet they're made, but that's part of also a democracy. That when people are given that kind of personal leeway, either individually or in the political realm, then of course you don't have a dictatorship, you don't have a unified thing. You have voices talking to one another, telling different stories and interpreting the world in different ways. But I think what ultimately what we say about what you've just mentioned is that flaws and limitations and hunches that weren't realized and hopes that weren't realized, the country nevertheless persists. There are millions who continue to be at the edge, and I in no way want to whistle Dixie about that. I know that there are serious problems. Lord knows I've spent my lifetime, as you pointed out, witnessing them and writing about them. But, you know, even the children I went through, got to know, who went through the horrible circumstances they did, they were young Americans, and they knew the value of this country, and some of them, I'm telling you, for all their difficulties, they had the American flag nearby, and they knew the story of this country, and they knew that they themselves were actors and actresses in that continuing historical drama, which is what this country is.
In your book about Bruce Springsteen, which might be a surprise to some people, you wrote a book called Bruce Springsteen's America, The People Listening and a Poet Singing, and it was both about the words of Springsteen as a poet and about the meaning that Americans, folks of all sorts, find in his words. One of the things you said was that he was able to avoid the nation overpraising of false patriotism and the nation over slamming of false attacks and so on, and sort of find that middle ground where real people are. I'm not attempting to slam the country, but I'm troubled. That's what I'm saying, is I'm troubled by when you have a freewheeling culture, an entrepreneurial culture, a risk-taking society as we do, then it seems to me those accountability places of accounting firms or Standard & Poor's or so, it becomes all the more important. And when I see it time after time that falling away, then I'm nervous about something deeper going wrong in at the core of all this. Some thoughts about that? You've looked at things with a much longer perspective than I.
Well, look, in the midst of progress and hopes being realized, there are disappointments and there are difficulties. Look, look what happened to this country recently. It's not the first time people invaded our airspace, killed people right in their hometown and at work, and there's a feeling of vulnerability. And by the way, I think the stronger you are, the more vulnerable you are, in the sense that you're an object of envy and rivalry. You're a reminder to others of their own disappointments and the pain that they're going through. So I think when you're first, in an ironic way, you're vulnerable, and there's a price to be paid, which we are witnessing now as this country deals with a lot of people in different continents who want to hurt us because we're who we are. We're the world's leading nation. We have an unparalleled amount of power and strength, and those folks want to take it away from us, to be blunt about it.
But I'm actually,
there's vulnerability in strength, and where there is an effort for unity, there are those fragments of disagreement. And of course, disagreement, by the way, is a healthy thing,
right,
in a society. If you have everyone agreeing with everyone else, you begin to wonder what kind of country you're living in, but not in this country.
Well,
there are sectional disagreements. There are disagreements based on occupation and on national backgrounds and all, and on race but whatever. But look, somehow the whole thing comes together.
Yeah, I'm actually less, in this question, less concerned about the attacks from abroad as from a sort of loss of moral compass internally, that we are allowing our, as I said, we're a risk-taking society, and so it's good if some rules, some standards are in place so that that can flourish rather than become dangerous. And that's really more the point I was making, but I will set that aside. Let me ask you if you could reflect for a moment as I'm listening to you, both the sound of the conversation and the content of the conversation, I'm reminded of Studs Terkel, who passed away just recently. Could you reflect just a little bit on who Studs Terkel was and how your work might compare?
Reflect on what?
Studs Terkel.
Studs Terkel, oh, listen, he was a hero of mine, a wonderful hero. I knew him. I met him. I was on his radio talk. I sat with him and drove with him in Chicago while he pointed places out to me. He was a great American historian. You want to call him a social historian? You want to call him a journalist? You want to call him a writer? Whatever you want to call him, he was a great American who was watchful of the country and paid enormous attention to it by listening, and very important, by getting others to say what they saw and heard so that their voices, their experiences, their memories became part of a collective national experience, because after all, for millions of people, Studs Terkel, among other things, was a great and continuing teacher. That's what he was, a social observer who knew how to get other people to work with him, and together they told America about itself.
Mm-hmm. I often say that one of the reasons that I do interviews and one of my hopes is that I can teach while learning.
Well, I think that's what a person like you and me does. He's, after all, we're teachers in a way, using, of course, in the best sense of the word using, better would be calling upon others to be colleagues, co-teachers, in interviews, in conversations, or doing it by picking up a book that a particular person has put words on, and put the words into the book and turning the book into a kind of companion.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you.
We're about human companionship connected to our national experience. We're all American companions in the story, the developing story of this country.
Mm-hmm. That's the voice of Robert Coles. Let me ask you, what you've observed happening to storytelling while you've been watching it and participating in it, and one of my questions is, have you thought about the role of the new social networking culture in which, the Facebooks and the MySpaces and all of that sort of thing, in which everyone gets to produce and publish the narrative of their life on a daily and sometimes multiple times in a daily basis, And there's some sort of an interactive nature there, which I think is something we haven't seen perhaps ever.
Well, I think we're doing a lot of that kind of interaction. I'm a little too old to be familiar with it the way my children and grandchildren are, but the computer, let's face it, is an instrument of human communication. And through the computer, among other new modes of connection, people are learning about one another and trying to understand through that experience the world they live in. Now, of course, like in all human connection, there can be flaws and mistakes, because people can take an instrument of communication and turn it into an instrument of hurtfulness, which we do with words when we speak to people, and there's no guarantee that a machine like a computer is going to eliminate what the Bible would remind us is our sinful side. You don't need the Bible to be reminded of that. Anyone who observes his or her fellow human beings, including himself or herself, will be reminded that we all have those moments when we don't exactly live up to what we hope we'd like to live up to. And I think these new methods of communication through videos and through computers are yet another instance of human beings speaking, listening, observing, trying to understand, perhaps with technological assistance, But let's face it, whatever technology does, it's going to always have to be used by people who have a brain and then have a language that they resort to either by speaking or writing or reading or whatever it is that enables that human connection that we've been talking about in this program.
The book that is your latest book, which you co-edited with Albert Lafarge, called Minding the Store, great writing about business. I read that it grew out of a course that you taught at Harvard Business School and elsewhere, in which you asked future money market managers, risk arbitrageurs, to pause for a semester and reflect on the ethical dimensions of their work. Now, if we go back to my earlier question about the crisis we find ourselves in because perhaps some of those ethics were questionable, what was your experience? How long did you teach that course? And what was your experience about those young business students and the ethical dimensions of the work they were going to go into?
Well, I taught a course at Harvard Business School that was basically based on literature. Writers such as John Updike or Cheever or Tolstoy or others told stories which then connected to human reality. And remember, business is about human reality. And those stories basically got some of those students going, because I still hear from them. They remember particular moments in a seminar in which we discussed the Tolstoy story or the Cheever story, the housebreaker of Shady Hill. If the listeners of this program do nothing else but get a copy of that book, but get a copy of John Cheever's story, The Housebreaker of Shady Hill, or Leo Tolstoy's story, Master and Man. Those two stories tell so much about what American business has been about, and as a matter of fact, what's going on now in the business world, because in the Cheever story, there's a story about a businessman who rusts a little bit too much for his neighbor's wealth, and maybe even considers taking something away from the neighbor's house, even as sometimes businesses have gotten in one another's way, and sometimes it even becomes illegal, as we're witnessing when we read some of the stories about business. And Tolstoy's story is about the dependence of the so-called boss and the worker, and how they need one another. We're back to what I've been talking about earlier about I, thou, and this is what those storytellers do. And the students who took that course, and I gave it for about 10 years, and who are now in the business world, I get letters from them all the time telling me that there'll be a moment when they're either going through something in their own business or their own personal lives, or when they're reading the paper or watching television or on the computer, when they stop and think about what Tolstoy said or wrote, rather, and what Updike or Cheever or others in that book. If I have to say so myself, I didn't write the book. I pulled these stories together. But Albert Lafarge and I pulled together a collection of stories that connect the reader to the world of commerce, to the world of stores, to the world of businesses, to the world, yes, of us who buy and purchase and hope and aspire and maybe hope to climb a ladder or a rung or two up a particular ladder. But they're wonderful ways, those stories, of looking not only at business, but ourselves who are either in business or would like to be, or who purchase from businesses or work at those businesses.
It looks to me the failures in the way that, let's say, subprime mortgages were combined together and sold as safer than subprime mortgages, that the short selling that has been rampant, people betting on others' failure, the credit default swaps that were basically a gambling casino on enormous leverage that could not stand, that would have enormous repercussions if there were failure, as there has been. Do the students that you were dealing with for those 10 years, who were going on to become You know, this is Harvard Business School. They are going on to become the investment bankers and so on. Do as you watch what's happening now, where it seems like people just went too far, any thoughts about moments in your teaching that provide a window into the ethical dimensions of what's going on?
Well, I think that the course enabled them to do that. But by the way, you don't need to take a course to do that. You don't even have to read a book to do it. You do it in your humanity. You stop and wonder and ask and reflect. That's what a lot of people are doing right now, as this country tries to figure out what the devil is it going to do, what happened to it. What happened to it politically and militarily even, and what's happening to it economically. You know, during the Great Depression, much greater than I hope anything we're going to go through now, much, much greater, there were a lot of writers, storytellers, who came out of that and wrote about it. And for that matter, it was the genius of the New Deal that it got the FSA going, the Farm Security Administration, in which photographers went across America with their cameras and basically told stories. They showed the viewers of those photographs what their fellow citizens had gone through, and there were always stories connected to what those pictures were conveying. In a sense, you had pictures and stories, just like we all have eyes and ears, and with the brain we connect the seen and the heard, and we figure things out. And that's what a Tolstoy or a Raymond Carver, who's also in that book, or an Updike or a Cheever, whatever, they all come together in minding the story. You'll notice it's not a big fancy academic title. It's an ordinary...
Oh, right, yeah.
It's the vernacular. It's the ordinary language of, I'm working, I'm minding the store. And we meant it to be that. We didn't want some fancy, abstract, social science essay. We wanted the ordinary stories of good American storytellers and other storytellers from all over the world as they dealt with human business. And we wanted those stories to resonate in the lives of those young people who are starting out themselves in that life. And by the way, as I mentioned earlier, I hear from some of those once students who are now in American businesses, and they go back to a moment when Tolstoy or Cheever or whatever, Studs Terkel, who's also in that book, helped them pause and reflect about what they're doing and why and to what effect.
Let me ask you...
In a sense, the writer helps restore the reader to his or her humanity, even as in the writing, the writer or the photographer with a camera attempts to connect to that humanity and convey it, and so doing, convey it to others.
As you have watched this last year in the presidential campaign of Barack Obama and finally the election of Barack Obama, a African-American man, a man in so many ways the opposite of the person he's replacing in his background and his intelligence and his curiosity and so on, What have you felt about that story?
Well, I'll tell you what I felt through these. One of the African-American kids I worked with a long time ago, they're the same age as Barack Obama is. They're in their late 40s. They went through mobs to go into schools in order to get an American education when those called segregationists were screaming at them and insulting them and threatening them. Now the country's gone through that, and one of them I spoke to called me up in amazement and said, can you imagine where we've gone since you and I used to sit and talk about the riots in New Orleans? That's in the early 1960s. That's 40-plus years ago. And now look what happened. And she said to me, it was very poignant, she said, I just think that this shows you that you always have to remind yourself that what is may not be later, and that later something will be different. Now, she's not a poet or a philosopher, but pretty close to being one. And she did a wonderful job of putting it to me. And then she jokingly, because she knew I used to ask children to draw pictures, she said, "Have you ever thought of asking him to draw pictures?" I said, "I don't think he needs to draw pictures. He's already drawing a very big picture for the American people to think about the story of his life and the story of what he and his wife are trying to do as American citizens." So it's a great American story, of which their story is a chapter in that continuing saga. Now, we all have a right to claim that our story is a part of that, too, but in a sense, these two are emblematic, and they give us pause to think, and they tell us in their own way, look at history as it unfolds and changes, and in which we have a, Howard Paul Tillich, the theologian, put it, a new being. That's what the Obamas are giving America politically, and maybe even morally and spiritually, a new kind of being. And it's liberating not only for people of color, I must insist, but for all of us of whatever color our skin and background. And that's, in a sense, they are instruments in the positive sense of the word, of instruments. They are instruments of an unfolding American history. And remember, the word story is a part of history, of an American political and social story. So we'll see how it unfolds, but I think the whole world is very taken by it, even as we are, and we'll wait and see, and it's quite an adventure for all of us.
Yes. In your book, Lives of Moral Leadership, you write, I'm just going to read a little bit here, "We need heroes, people who can inspire us to help shape us morally, spur us on to purposeful action. And from time to time, we are called on to be those heroes, leaders for others, either in a small, day-to-day way, or on the world's larger stage. At this time in America and in the rest of the world, we seem to need moral leadership especially, but the need for moral inspiration is ever present. We need to hand one another along through the moral leadership we show or through how we support it in others." What are you seeing in terms of the need and the response for moral leadership right now?
Well, we're looking for it in people. And by the way, not only for people in politics, I hear every day. I heard a story the other day about a police officer who went out of his way to help someone who was in trouble. He was off duty. He didn't have to do it. And at the risk of his life, he went to intervene and help someone. And talk about moral leadership. Who would want? He could have gone on. He had other stuff to do. He had all the excuses of someone who had to be here and do that. But he stopped himself in his tracks, and he reached out to another human being, even at the jeopardy of his own life, never mind the time he was spending and maybe even the hurt feelings of people who he was keeping waiting. There is the bind that we get into as we try to realize our moral possibilities, even as, to do so, we occasionally have to stop ourselves in a track and maybe even hurt ourselves. We know that. We know that we're willing to reach out to others. And sometimes, just the other day, I read about someone who was giving her blood voluntarily to a stranger who needed a certain kind of blood to stay alive. But I thought, my Lord, you talk about human connection. Volunteers, reads in the paper, picks up the phone, takes the body to have blood taken from it, and in a very quiet way is thankful to be able to do that. If that isn't heroism, I don't know what is.
Let me finally...
moral energy lived out, and let me tell you, I think the people listening to this, they know, so many of them, instances where they've been stopped in their tracks, and either they or someone else has gone beyond the realm of the ordinary and tried to, well, repeating what Ian Forster said, to connect with, by the way, in connecting with others, they're connecting with themselves, with their own value and purpose as human beings. I knew one person who was constantly volunteering, and I asked her whether there was some reason for that. Maybe she'd been brought up to do this, or someone was inspiring her, and she said, you know, I think I do this because it helps me to find out who I am.
Right.
A very interesting way of putting it. And in so doing, I become, I think, more alive to who I am or might be than if I didn't do it. A nice way, no bragging, no pomposity, just a humble way of saying that sometimes, yes, I'll put it this way, in giving, we receive. In giving, we receive.
Well, that's a good note in this week of Thanksgiving. Finally, let me ask you, and if this question makes no sense, just tell me so. But in the story that most people tell themselves, the big story about who we are and what we're doing and so on, is your sense that given that we have climate crises and ecological crises and we still have so many other crises facing us, do you sense that people believe that we're ultimately going to make it?
They must assume that from day to day, of course, we're going to make it. They don't want to fall victim to despair. They want to insist that with their efforts and the efforts of all the people all over the world, somehow we will make it. And remember, let's not get too egoistic about it in the sense that let's get some perspective. Whatever we're going through now, believe me, people have gone through much, much worse, both in this country and, of course, in other countries. So a little perspective that stops us from being a little too much tied up to a particular news story or a particular sequence of events.
Okay, I'm gonna end it there. So again, the new book is Minding the Store, great writing about business, Tolstoy to now. Thank you to Robert Coles. Keep up the good work.